Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Kathy with a K.
And I'm Kathy with a C.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is Moscow, Idaho. We are back for a comprehensive wrap-up of the Brian Koberger case. All of us remember hearing about the brutal murders of the four young college students in Moscow, Idaho in November of 2022. And we remember their names. Kaylee Gonzalez, Maddie Mogan, Zanna Kernodal, and Ethan Chapin. And their two surviving roommates were Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk. Now remember, 6 weeks after the murders, 28-year-old Brian Koberger was arrested at his parents' home in Pennsylvania, and he was a student at Washington State University in Pullman, getting his PhD in criminal justice. And Pullman is just 10 miles from Moscow, Idaho. And Moscow, Idaho is the site of the University of Idaho. Koberger was charged with 4 counts of murder and burglary. Would you like to describe for the great folks what burglary actually is? Because I always mix it up.
Everyone thinks burglary is a theft crime, and burglary is simply breaking into a home with the intent to commit a felony, not a theft crime necessarily.
Now, we also know that he was denied bail, and we're not going to go into all those details for this episode, but if you do want to hear all the information leading up to it, it's episode 71.
And of course, last month, on July 2nd, 2025, the world was stunned to hear that the prosecution had pulled the death penalty off the table in order to have Brian Koberger plead guilty to 4 counts of first-degree murder and burglary in exchange for life in prison. The judge gave him 4 consecutive life sentences, which is, I believe, mandatory under Idaho law, a life sentence for murder one. So the judge took Koberger's guilty plea, and in the hearing, he said, "Are you pleading guilty because you are in fact guilty?" And Koberger said, "Yes." So the judge ordered the life sentences, 4 life sentences to be served consecutively, and an additional 10 years for the burglary. And this is life without the possibility of parole.
Or what do we call that?
LWOP.
Thank you.
Kathy's favorite.
I know. And what some people may have heard a lot about is that when it was first announced that Koberger was going to take this plea, as you can imagine, a lot of the families of these victims were outraged and were very vocal about this. They wanted him to be convicted with the death penalty and to no longer be part of this earth.
Yeah.
And some of the families were like, "We just want him never to be able to do this to anybody else ever again, no matter how they get to that point."
Yeah, I think it was Mr. Gonzalez who was the most outspoken about wanting death. And a lot of legal commentators were sort of like, if this case doesn't cry for the death penalty, what does?
True.
And I don't think Idaho is overly active on the death penalty.
They're not. Actually, in Idaho's history, and I just found this out, they've only used the death penalty 3 times.
Oh my gosh, I'm shocked by that.
Yeah, I am too.
The sentencing of Brian Koberger took place on July 23rd, 2025, which was the same day that the judge released a bunch of documents that were previously sealed. And that is a process. We'll talk about that at the end. That's a process that's still ongoing. So what we'd like to do is take you back to the day of the murders and just sort of explain everything in the comprehensive format that we now know it. That day was a big football game for the University of Idaho where these kids went to school, and they all started, you know, doing the typical pre-gaming and, you know, pre-gaming early. They got back to the house at about 4 o'clock that afternoon and decided they were going to take naps, which who doesn't love a nap? And they set their alarms for 8 o'clock so that they didn't want to sleep through the night. They wanted to have a good time that night. So Zanna and Ethan, along with Bethany Funk, went to a party at a Sigma Chi house. And that was just a short walk away.
Now, and really quickly, remember that Ethan Chapin was Zanna Kernodal's boyfriend.
Exactly. He was not a roommate, but he was there on the evening, unfortunately. So those three went to a Sigma Chi party and were home at about 1:45 in the morning. So after they got home, Dylan and Bethany and a third friend of theirs watched Vampire Diaries in the living room, which was on the second floor of the house. And we're going to describe the house in a minute. Kaylee and Maddie had gone to a local bar until about 1:45 in the morning. And after that, they went to a food truck and they arrived home at about 2 o'clock. So at about 2 a.m., all six of them were home. Ethan, the visitor, and the five roommates. Although Kaylee technically did not live there anymore, she was planning on graduating early, I believe.
She had the credits to graduate early. I'm not sure she was in school at that point, to be honest with you. What I had read with NBC News is that she'd taken a job that was based in Austin, Texas. I don't know if she actually was moving. I don't know if it was going to be a remote job.
But I think she was planning on technically graduating in December.
Correct.
So she was a smart gal. She was graduating a semester early, got an IT job, had her life dialed in. And she was there because obviously Maddie was her best friend. And she had just gotten a car. She bought a car for herself.
A brand new car.
Yes. And so she wanted to show her friend her car. And
It was a brand new Range Rover.
Everyone was home at about 2 a.m. Sometime between 2 and 2:30 in the morning, Maddie and Bethany took Kaylee's dog, Murphy, outside to transact his business. Maddie stayed outside for a bit with the dog. Neither girl at this point noticed anything suspicious. Bethany went to bed, and Bethany lived on the first floor, and we'll talk about the house in a minute. Maddie subsequently came down to Bethany and said, "Did you see where the dog went?" Bethany thought it was kind of odd, but no, she hadn't seen where the dog went. Eventually, we know that that dog got back into the house, and we know this because when the police arrived at the scene, Murphy was in Kaylee's bedroom hiding under a desk, and Kaylee and Maddie were dead in Maddie's bed. Let's talk about the house. The house was built into the side of a hill. And so it was three levels. The first level was at the street level. That's where the front door was. And so the first level was very, very simple. You kind of walked into this foyer or hallway. Immediately to your left, there's a staircase leading to the second level. On the first level, there were just two bedrooms and a bathroom. One of the bedrooms was used for storage, and the other one was where Bethany lived. So if you go up to the second level, now the second level, because it was built into the side of the hill, the entrance at the second level was a slider. It was a big glass slider that led into the kitchen.
Off a patio.
Yes, exactly. They had a patio, a slider, and you entered into the kitchen. The second level was really the communal living level. It had a bathroom, it had a nice sized living room. And then when you walked out of the kitchen and into the kind of like hallway area, there was a staircase up to your right that led to the third level. And then to your left was the living room area. On the other side of the staircase was a bedroom, and kitty corner across the house was a bedroom. So the staircase next to the bedroom was Dylan's room. And the one kitty corner across on the second level was Zanna's bedroom. Taking the staircase up to the third level was the smallest level, clearly an addition. And that's where Kaylee once had a bedroom and Maddie had a bedroom. In Kaylee's bedroom, she had a slider that led out to a balcony, and this balcony ran the length of the third floor. And then there was a bathroom upstairs as well. So a nice big house.
That's an awesome college house.
A totally awesome college house. So from the back of the house, if Kaylee were standing on her balcony, she would have been looking at a copse of trees. It wasn't a forest. It was, but it was very foresty.
It was. It separated the other houses, so you couldn't see them at all, really. Like, you might get a little tiny glimpse of them, but it was no Southern California. So as we said, we got the Moscow Police Department reports that they put out 300 files. Information, and some of it was so boring you just wanted to cry your eyes out.
Some of the information, in fact, most of the information was not interesting and it was useless. And actually, when you're doing a homicide investigation as a detective and you talk to anyone who's a potential witness, especially in this kind of case that is going to be scrutinized so heavily and, you know, you have to cross your T's and dot your I's, anytime you speak with somebody, you have to write a report summarizing the conversation. And so, as you can imagine, with this case, a lot of cuckoo people called in saying they knew it wasn't Brian Koberger. Like, you know, once he was caught, it couldn't have been him. Or I know who the real person is. Like, all of these reports, supplemental reports written by detectives and police officers for every single
big
person they talked
to.
Yeah, it was, you know, so it was actually painful. They dropped a zip file with a billion PDFs in it, and it was painful going through.
According to these reports, though, that we found, there was some information that wasn't available at the beginning of this whole case, which, of course, is not surprising. When we first did this episode, there was a lot of speculation as to how Koberger got into the house, but now we know. The kitchen slider that Kathy referred to, that was the point of entry and the point of exit. So they know this in a couple of ways. One of them is that it was wide open when the police got there, and it was northern Idaho in late November, mid-November. It's going to be cold. Those kids aren't going to be doing that. And one of the police officers who was first on the scene, he noticed footprints walking away from that slider, but also walking to the slider. There weren't any footprints like this down by the front door. So therefore, they knew that this had to have been the entry and exit method for Koberger. According to these police reports, Kath, one of the things that they revealed is that at about 4 o'clock, Dylan Mortensen, now she was one of the roommates who lived on the second floor. Her bedroom was the one that was kind of adjacent to the kitchen, but it was right next to the staircase. So if you were on those stairs, you had to pass by Dylan's room. At about 4 o'clock in the morning, Dylan heard somebody scream from upstairs. And of course, upstairs was where Maddie and Kaylee lived. Dylan said that she thought the voice was Kaylee's and that Kaylee had screamed, "Somebody's here." According to grand jury transcripts, which we got from a motion in limine court record, Dylan also heard strange noises and crying coming from the bathroom.
Right. And that really makes no sense. Like she thought she heard crying coming from the bathroom, but there's no indication that any of the victims were ever in a bathroom.
Correct. The one on the second floor was over past the kitchen toward Zana's room, but the one on the third floor was at the top of the stairs.
Yeah.
I think that she thought,
at least according to these grand jury transcripts, that Kaylee was crying in the upstairs bathroom.
Right. Now, Dylan also told police that she heard Kaylee run from the third floor down to the second floor, across the living room toward Zana's room. Of course, now we know that that wasn't Kaylee, that was Koberger. Dylan, of course, was freaked out and scared, so she locked herself in her bedroom and continued to hear some sort of commotion going on. Once she stopped hearing what she thought was a struggle, she heard a male voice say, "You're going to be fine. I'm going to help you." Dylan told police that she did not recognize the male voice. But after a few minutes, Dylan peeked out of her bedroom. And when she looked, she saw a tall man dressed all in black with a ski cap pulled down over his face. She couldn't see his face at all, obviously, but what she did notice was that he had big, bushy eyebrows. Dylan then started calling and texting her other roommates, but the only one she heard back from was Bethany. And as we told you, Bethany lived in the first floor.
Bethany told police that she woke up in her bedroom to a sound that she described as a firecracker and a flash. She initially thought that somebody was pulling a prank. She also started calling her roommates after hearing this loud noise. And of course, nobody responded. So according to Bethany's phone log, she called Zana at 4:21 in the morning. She then called Ethan. She then called Maddie. She then called Maddie a few minutes later. And then she also tried Kaylee. Of course, no response whatsoever.
This was over the span of like 10 minutes.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So during this same time, Bethany and Dylan on their separate floors are texting each other. We're going to read the text message exchange. And this went on from like 4:22 to 4:26. Dylan said to Bethany, "No one is answering." Then she said, "I'm really confused right now." Then she sent a message to Kaylee, and the text simply said, "Kaylee." Dylan then asked Bethany, "What's going on?" Bethany responds, "Yeah, dude, WTF. And then Bethany says, "Zana was wearing all black." And so this is what I think happened. I think that when they were having a phone conversation, Dylan told Bethany, I saw somebody wearing all black. So in this text exchange, and this is me speculating.
So speculation warning.
But it makes sense.
It does.
Because we really don't know the nature of the phone call. I think the phone call between the two girls lasted like 26 seconds. And then they start this texting and, you know, trying to get a hold of their friends. So I suspect that Dylan told Bethany, hey, like, I saw somebody in black. And so here in this text, Bethany says, Zanna was wearing all black. Dylan then says, I'm freaking out right now. No, it's like a ski mask almost. And then Bethany says, STFU. And then she says, actually. And then Dylan said, like he had something over his head and around his mouth. Dylan then says, Bethany, I'm not kidding. I'm so freaked out. Bethany says, so am I. Dylan says, my phone is going to die. And Bethany says, come to my room, run down here. And then Dylan says, I'm scared though. And Bethany says, yeah, I know, but it's better than being alone.
It's so true. I can't imagine the level of panic.
I can't. I know. And the thing is, it's like these girls both heard something that they couldn't identify. Dylan was hearing sounds that she thought, you know, came from a bathroom. She thought
Kaylee
had run downstairs. And so something was happening. They weren't sure what it was. And they were both scared because none of their friends are responding. Anyway, so Dylan runs down to Bethany's room. And then Dylan's phone activity shows that she got little to no sleep that night. So she was, you know, the forensic experts looked at her phone and they could tell, you know, what she was looking at and, you know, who she was talking to, texting, whatever. Okay. So it looked like she pretty much lied awake all night.
Yeah. Even with the adrenaline, like, it doesn't say this. I would have pushed a chest of drawers against the door. I would have, you know, one of those like cartoons where you have like 12 different things that are going up on top of it.
And we don't know that they didn't do that. You know
no,
what I mean?
We don't. But I'd still be afraid. You've got a window to worry about.
Yeah. No, I totally hear you. So at about 10:30 in the morning, Dylan began texting Maddie and Kaylee asking if they were awake. And each of the girls thought that was weird because they were early risers,
right.
But there was no response from either of them for obvious reasons. She also checked the locations of Zanna and Ethan. So she was obviously a girl in distress. And I want to say something because a lot of people are like, why didn't she call 911? It's because they're like 19 and 20 or something like that. They're young and you can't imagine, like, your mind does not want to believe that
you saw what you saw,
that something evil was happening. And the truth is, the fact is, even if she had called 911, the minute she heard anything, those four kids would still be dead. Nothing would have changed. And so
it was too brutal.
It was. Yeah. And so I personally am not a fan of the Monday morning quarterbacking of Dylan and Bethany. These four kids would still be dead. And these two survivors have to
live with it. The survivor's guilt has to just be powerful.
When we were watching, you know, Dylan's, witness statement, it was coming out of every pore in her body. That was hard. And we'll get into that.
So finally, just before noon, Dylan texted her friend Emily, who lived just in the house next door, but it was still up the road a little bit, to come over because she was freaked out about what was happening. And so Emily actually brought her boyfriend Hunter along with her. Hunter has Bethany and Dylan leave the house with Emily and stand out in front. He goes upstairs because, of course, they were at the first floor when they got there. He goes upstairs in the kitchen and he grabs a steak knife. The first room he went to was Zanna's, and he immediately saw Zanna on the ground. Nothing more was reported about what he saw, other than he immediately went downstairs to the front of the house. I guess he was pale as a ghost. He told Bethany and Dylan and Emily, call 911, someone is unconscious. And then he would not let these girls go back into the house. So they call 911. They talk to dispatch. Dylan was actually the one who was talking to dispatch. She's clearly freaking out. I mean, even though Hunter didn't say that the person was no longer with us, or even who it was, actually, she had to have known. She was breathing heavily. She was almost hyperventilating. And then she kept passing the phone to people when the dispatch would ask a question. if she didn't know the answer, she'd hand it to someone else. And dispatch was amazing, but you could tell they were like, I need to only talk to one person. Five different times the phone was passed. But finally,
four times she's like, I need you to stop passing the phone. I'm always amazed at 911 dispatchers. Like, they're receiving calls from people in distress, the distress of their life. And they have to just be super, super cool. And it blows my mind, honestly, that people can do that. I'd be like, oh my God, no.
Exactly. You know,
like, anyway, so
can you put me on speaker?
Yeah, it's kind of a long 911 call, and we're not going to bother playing it. But Dylan is clearly in distress, and it is obvious that the girls do not know the nature and extent, but their instincts are screaming that something is horrific. Like, for example, at the end of the call, the 911 operator was saying, "Do you have a defibrillator?" And she's like, "No, we don't." And then the police officer gets to the scene. And so I think it was Dylan asked, do you have a defibrillator? And the officer's like, yes, I do. And so they had no idea the magnitude of the situation.
Exactly. So the first responding officer was an officer named Mitch Nunez. And what's funny is, and I saw this in one of the, you know, maybe tabloid magazines.
Right, right.
But it said that, and I believe this, he'd only been on the force for a year. He was 22 years old. And so, of course, he's walking up as a police officer to all these kids who are right around his own age, there to protect them.
Right.
And I think that's awesome. So he, of course, goes into the house, has Hunter and everybody else stay outside. He goes in to find out what's happened. Because remember, he still thinks it's an unconscious person in the house. And he walks in.
Goes up to the second floor.
Exactly. And immediately saw what Hunter had seen. And that was Xana, who was no longer breathing. He also looked further in the bedroom and saw that Ethan, Xana's boyfriend, was also no longer alive. And so once he saw those two, he backed out of the house and waited for additional officers to arrive so that they could go through the house, make sure there were no suspects or anything else, and, you know, secure the scene.
Right. And those officers arrived very quickly.
Yeah.
So there were three main officers who arrived at the scene.
One of the first three responding officers, Officer Gunderson, wrote the following account. He said, when I got to the second floor, I saw a female covered in blood in one of the bedrooms on the second floor. I believe this female to be Xana. I looked inside the bedroom Xana was laying in, and it was obvious an intense struggle had occurred. Xana was obviously deceased. There was blood smeared on various items in the room and all over the floor. There was blood cast off on the walls in various places, including above Xana's body. Xana was on her back on the floor in the center of the room. She was in her underwear and a long-sleeved gray shirt. Both her shirt and underwear were covered in blood. Xana's face and body were covered in dried blood. I could see what appeared to be defensive knife wounds on Xana's hands. There was a deep gash on Xana's left hand between her pointer finger and thumb. A partially covered male was on the bed and was also obviously deceased. I believe this male to be Ethan. The midsection of Ethan's body was covered with a blanket. His head wasn't visible and appeared to be between the bed and a wall. There was some blood cast off and what appeared to be arterial blood spray above where Ethan's head was located.
Officer Gunderson then went upstairs to the third level where Kaylee and Maddie were, and about this he wrote, I also went to the other bedroom on the third floor where Officer Nunes and Warner advised they found two females whom I believe to be Kaylee and Maddie. Both females were obviously deceased. I observed Kaylee lying on the north side of the bed and Maddie lying on the south side of the bed with their heads toward the east. Kaylee and Maddie were covered by a pink blanket, which was covered in blood. There was a large pool of blood near Kaylee's midsection. There was blood cast off on the east and north walls above Kaylee and Maddie. Maddie appeared to be laying up against Kaylee. Maddie had what appeared to be wounds on her forearms and hands. Maddie had a gash under her right eye, which appeared to go from the corner of her eye to her nose. Kaylee was unrecognizable as her facial structure was extremely damaged. I asked Officer Nunes to close the door to the bedroom so the dog did not try to get in to disturb the scene.
And this is referring to Kaylee's bedroom where the dog had been found.
Exactly. I collected the dog from the third floor and took it outside, and the dog was transported to the Humane Society on my behalf. One of the things that the family suspected, and I believe the FBI suspected, and probably the Moscow police suspected, was that there was a second weapon. and this was because of the nature of the damage to Kaylee's face. I have no idea if a butt of a knife can cause that damage, but it was widely believed that there was more than one weapon. And of course, the police found the K-bar knife sheath on the bed with the girls. And one of the things also, Kath, that I read, or that was part of, you know, these records, was that there's now a crowd gathering because the scene is roped off.
And they've got their phones. They were texting everyone they know.
Oh, everybody. And the first officer on the scene, the young one, what's his name?
Nunes.
Exactly. So he's now collecting witness statements. You know, certain officers were put in charge of certain areas to make sure there was no, you know, there was one posted up at the back door because there were the footprints. They didn't want anybody else coming or going, you know, all that kind of
all
stuff.
All the crime scene tape was going up around all of the trees and all of that.
Exactly. So Kaylee's ex-boyfriend, with whom she shared this dog, shows up at the scene, you know, and tells officers who he is, introduces himself. And here's what's interesting. He talks about how he shares, you know, Murphy with Kaylee. And in the police report that I was reading in one of these supplemental reports, it specifically says he had no visible cuts on his hand. No bruises were noted. It appeared that he had nothing indicating that he was in a fight. And so they told him, okay, go get the dog. It's at the Humane Society. So he had to do that.
But isn't that interesting? Because I guess he was also very open with answering questions by the officers.
Right.
Like, who are you? What are you doing? But if an ex-boyfriend, and they'd been together for 5 years and had only recently broken up. And of course, that's going to be a suspect.
Yeah. But I also...
He handled it perfectly.
I read that they had a good relationship after the breakup.
I read the same thing.
But anyway, so also, this is so sad. Zanna's father walks up to a police officer and says, I'm looking for my daughter. And introduces who he is and says, my daughter is here with me. Zanna's sister was, you know, out front. And so the officer says, do you know the names of the occupants? Yes, I do. And they said, would you mind coming to the police station with us? They take Zanna's father and sister to the police station where they break the news to him that she was murdered.
Can you imagine?
No, I can't. I just can't.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
As we all know now, the thing about the crime scene is that there was so little evidence. It was by the grace of God that fool dropped his knife sheath.
Yeah.
And I am assuming it's because they were fighting. Anyway, fortunately, there was a spot of blood on it, so they had the DNA. But there was really nothing else at the crime scene identifying him. Even the shoe prints, like they were, what were they able to determine?
So with the shoes, they were able to determine just a couple of simple things. One of them is that obviously they were in the snow. They were measured as being 13 and a half to 14 inches long. And there was a tread pattern on top of the snow that looked like it matched a Van's shoe. But it was snow and it's not like dirt. It's a little harder to get prints from, obviously. Yeah. And that really didn't go anywhere from what I can understand. And at a college, how many thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of Vans might you have?
So and the defense knew if they could get the DNA evidence excluded,
done.
You know, it would be tough. It'd be super tough on the prosecution, even though the prosecutor said I could get a conviction without the DNA.
Now, just a quick recap with this. And we all know what happened afterwards, right? The first thing the police did is they looked at the ring cameras around the house. They noticed that there was a white Elantra, sent it off to the FBI, who was already helping them. They determined it was a 2011 to 2015 Hyundai Elantra. They started then looking at other people's cameras. They noticed that there was a car that had gone down a different street and had made a three-point turn and then gone back in front of the house on King Road. And, you know, just white Elantra, white Elantra, white Elantra. And they were able to track the car so that after it left the house at 4:20 in the morning, driving like a bat out of hell, they went to the State Route 270, which goes straight to Pullman, Washington. The Moscow police contacted the Washington State University police and said, hey, we're looking for this car. And they didn't have a plate on it because it didn't have a front plate. Mm-hmm. And just, hey, can you check your parking lots? And so it was just...
And they put out a bolo.
Well, yeah, they put out a bolo. That wasn't the only thing they did.
Right.
But it was that call to Washington State Police that, of course, had them come up with their suspect.
Right.
The university police, they were on top of this.
Yeah, they did a great job.
One of them went through the database immediately, found a car registered with Pennsylvania plates, went to the off-campus housing where it was supposed to be located, didn't find it. Another officer was driving parking lots, and he came across a white Elantra with Washington State plates on them, not Pennsylvania, like it was in the database, but the names were the same. So it turned out that just a couple of days after this murder was committed, Koberger actually changed his registration from Pennsylvania to Washington. Washington State Police contacted Moscow with this information, and they were able to run it through their database. It turned out that in the weeks before the murder, a Moscow police officer had actually pulled over this white Elantra with Brian Koberger in it. The officer wore a body cam, so you saw Koberger in this white Elantra connecting him to the car. Can't say that it wasn't his or he borrowed it or whatnot.
Right.
The deputy also got his cell phone number, and so now they were able to start pinging towers.
Exactly.
And they were able to go back and look, how often was this guy here?
And of course, one of the things, Kath, when the Washington State police officers contacted the Moscow PD, of course, they look him up on the DMV database and they see this freaking guy with caterpillar eyebrows, you know?
6 feet tall, just like Dylan had described.
Yep.
Anyway, so Brian Koberger leaves, daddy comes out to get him, drive home for Christmas holidays. Police are tracking him in every state, as we know, but they get there, they popo do a stakeout, they get DNA out of the trash can that went out to the curb, so it's no longer private, and the Idaho State Crime Lab was able to determine that this DNA belonged to the biological father of the donor on the K-Bar knife sheath. Koberger was arrested about 6 weeks after the murder. This was bang up, man. They
totally
did a great job.
They had his name about... What was it, like
2 weeks?
10 days, 2 weeks?
Yeah.
After the murders. This was an incredible... And FBI was helping.
Yeah.
Everybody was
Idaho
helping.
Idaho State Police, all
yeah,
of them.
Exactly.
I mean, tiny little Moscow.
Yeah.
You know, you take the university out of that city and they don't have a large year-round population, is my guess.
But anyway, so everybody, it was such an impressive thing. And of course, once they, you know, did the cell tower pinging, they just saw how many times this guy, over and over. And it'll probably say in our original episode, I cannot remember how many weeks or months they saw him visiting this house.
I seem to recall it being like summer is when he started.
Yeah, I don't remember specifically, but it was obvious he was after them. And there was a lot of speculation as to who it was specifically that he was interested in. And people generally think it was Maddie.
You know, the challenge was people were like, if he pleads guilty, we'll never know why. Why did he do it? Who was he after? The fact is, he was never going to tell you in the first place.
He was never going to take
the
stand.
Even if he had a story, why would you trust anything that came out of his mouth?
Fake.
It would be. He would think, fake. I'm fooling all these people once again, and I'm going to come up with the most elaborate story.
Yeah.
So we'll never know. But you know what? He just needs to go away.
I know. Consistent with the fact that cell towers were pinging around this house for quite some time, in the records that were released, we see Bethany, when she was interviewed by the police, said that about a month before the murder, Kaylee had taken her dog Murphy outside when she saw an unknown man above the house on the south. So this is like up the hill and in the trees, staring at her. And she was so freaked out that she told all her roommates about it and called them to say, hey, when are you coming home? I think that'd be terrifying.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And then a friend of Kaylee's also told police that a couple months before the murder, she made reference to having a stalker. The friend said that she thought Kaylee said something about having received something in the mail. And she couldn't be more specific about it. But some of the other friends who were at lunch with Kaylee and this girl also thought Kaylee mentioned getting a strange message on Facebook. And then just 9 days before the attack, the roommates came home at about 11 in the morning to find the front door wide open and the hinges loose. And of course, that freaked him out, and Zanna's dad fixed the door. And so some people have speculated that Brian Koberger actually was in the house before the night of the murders, you know, just being a nosy busybody and
getting the layout,
freaky stalker or whatever. But there isn't any actual evidence of that.
Yeah, no fingerprints, no hair, nothing.
Nothing. You know, no Ring doorbell video showing him. You know, like, we just, you know, we don't know. You know, it was a theme, let's say, of the friends that Kaylee felt watched.
There was also speculation, if you'll recall, because a couple of times when Kaylee would let the dog out, the dog would run back to this copse of trees. And while Murphy was apparently very obedient, when Kaylee called the dog, Murphy would not come back. Mm-hmm. And so there is speculation, again, total speculation, that Koberger was trying to get the dog used to his scent and probably giving him treats, which is why he wasn't leaving the trees to go back to mom, who wasn't going to give him any food.
Right.
I mean, and again, we just don't know.
Right. Because neither Bethany or Dylan told police that the dog was barking excessively.
Right. Exactly.
You know, the next door neighbor said she heard a dog and she assumed it came from the victim's residence. But the gals inside didn't say anything about the barking dog, which again lends credibility to sort of the theory that the dog knew Koberger. So let's get to the victim impact statements, which happened at the sentencing hearing on July 23rd. At the beginning of the hearing, I thought it was very interesting because the judge did his own introduction to the case, essentially. He thanked the attorneys for their professionalism, and he talked about just the conduct of everybody in the courtroom. One of the things the judge pointed out in his statement was that Koberger admitted to everything, but we still don't know why. And like, you could tell at certain parts, the judge was getting a little bit choked up and basically expressed the frustration of not knowing why. But also, it's almost like, why does it matter?
But again,
the guy was a weirdo.
And again, he wasn't going to tell the truth.
No, I agree. My personal opinion is that he was an incel.
We were talking about this. So do you remember we did the case about Elliot Roger, UC Santa Barbara? Do you remember this?
He
shot up UC Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Total incel. And I have to say, I was shocked nobody referred to Koberger as that. He's a classic incel.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's probably people have referred to him as that, but wasn't
like
a
media.
Popular.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, many people took the angle of like, oh, he wanted to. Although it's all speculation. What the hell do we know?
Yeah.
Like, I just think he was.
But like how he treated women.
I think he was an incel.
He thinks he's too good for everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like, I just, you know.
We call incel.
I think, yeah. I honestly think most people describe incel, whether they use the phrase or not.
That's true.
And they thought it was Maddie because she worked at a restaurant that he frequented.
Yeah. So she worked at a restaurant in Moscow called the Mad Greek. And it was a vegan restaurant. And if you'll recall from Koberger's demands once he was incarcerated, he only ate vegan food, which I believe that has changed now because I don't think that they cater to vegan inmates.
I sure hope not. And he's in a lockdown. He's in a, what do you call it? I'm calling it a high power module, but he is in a solitary cell for 23 hours a day. He gets 1 hour out and he gets to shower every other day. Extremely controlled. I can't imagine being with my thoughts for 23 hours.
But if you love yourself as much as he does, and he does, you know he loves just having his thoughts.
I don't know. Who was the... it was Kaylee Gonzalez's sister at the hearing who said...
So wait, really quickly, if you haven't had a chance to listen to these victim impact statements, there's a couple that you should.
Right.
But if you can only listen to one, listen to Kaylee Gonzalez's sister, Olivia.
I thought she was fantastic.
Rock star.
Yeah. And I loved how, you know, she's upset. She's crying as it starts out. And then she gets more brittle as she is addressing him directly. And oh my God, when she called him basic.
Yeah.
And he said,
every word she could throw out there to demean him.
She called him
in
stupid.
His words.
Yeah.
Exactly.
She really like gave it to him. And one of the things that I thought was cool is she was talking about how torturous the whole process has been, and that she had been journaling along the way, all of her anger and rage and denial and sadness and everything. And so she was going to, as sort of an homage to Kaylee and Maddie, she was going to read some of those journal entries. And then she was like, no, I'm not going to do that.
You don't get this.
Exactly. You don't get this. And then she just like laid into him and, you know, and she ended with.
That was the best.
She's like, if you hadn't have crept up on them while they were sleeping,
like a pedophile,
Kaylee would have kicked your ass.
And then she did that. She's like, Kaylee would have kicked your ass. And then like in a flourish walked away.
Yeah. People were like,
exactly.
Clapping.
Like it was the perfect mic drop moment. Kaylee's dad, Mr. Gonzalez, has been very vocal about how he wanted this handled because he wanted Koberger to pay, and I begrudge him in no way. He had a great poignant thing. He was doing the same thing. You're stupid. You're a loser. You know, what do these A's do for you? You know, blah, blah, blah.
Nobody cares about you. Yes. Everybody is here because of the four victims, not because of you. You're a nobody.
We won't even say your name anymore. That name does not leave our lips. We only use your initials. You are only BK to us, and soon that's going to be gone too. But here was my favorite thing. As powerful as Mr. Gonzalez was, Mrs. Gonzalez had arguably one of the best lines.
Yeah.
She said to BK, you may have received A's in high school, but you're going to be getting big D's in prison.
I know. I know.
And there were people like, you know, everybody has an opinion on it. Some people were like, that's not appropriate. You know, that's inappropriate language. Others were like, that's homophobic. But, you know, that's probably one of the things he's most scared about, honestly. Yeah.
Bethany had a friend read a statement for her. She was not present in court. And one of the things that I liked about Bethany's statement was that it was like she took each of her friends one by one and talked about them and talked about how special they were. And she also addressed the survivor's guilt that she had. And she addressed the fact that I wish I would have done things differently kind of thing. I think implying that she would have called the police sooner. But she also acknowledged it wouldn't have made a difference. And she's 100% correct.
And she said that she had slept in her parents' bedroom for the first year after this happened, after the murders, and still has that fear.
They're so young. Of course, thinking of the burdens that she and Dylan have to shoulder. And when Dylan spoke, like I said, every pore was just oozing grief.
And agony.
Agony. And sorrow. And she talked about the panic attacks. She talked about just how it affected her. She too was sleeping in her mother's bedroom because she was afraid that somebody was going to come in the minute she shut her eyes. And one of the things that she did, and this totally happens with victims of crime, when you put yourself in a situation, let's say I'm going to a friend's house, she talked about how every time she went someplace, she had to like find the escape route. If something happens, if somebody comes in, how am I going to get out? Is there anyone around to help me? Like, so that loop in your brain 24/7, that is a burden.
And they said they never sleep. I can't imagine like what would go through your head when you slept. These young women, their lives have just been turned upside down.
I know, by a man who is clearly influenced by the devil.
Yep,
you know,
absolutely.
It's so sad. I feel terrible for both of them. And I don't like the Monday morning quarterbacking, criticizing them for not calling 911. It wouldn't have mattered.
Well, and we've talked about it even on other things where there was something we talked about recently, and I honestly wish I could remember what it was, but it was like, oh, it was the episode that we just did in DeWitt, New York, how John Jamelski had that young girl with him at a karaoke bar. And we're like, oh, you know, we would have called and said something was weird. The fact is you wouldn't have.
Right.
You know, you just wouldn't have. You can't Monday morning quarterback even something like that, let alone these two young women, you know, what they went through.
Yeah.
We just don't know.
I know. As it stands, 5 days ago, the judge signed an order and he basically writes, as part of the process to review sealed records to determine which should be unsealed, the court will process the review of those documents from newest to oldest. The court will require the parties to indicate whether they have an objection to unsealing any specific document and if they believe the document should remain sealed. So 5 days ago, the judge listed 43 documents that are up for consideration as to unsealing. And he asked, you know, each side, the prosecution and defense, to state whether or not they think the documents should be unsealed and why. The court is going to be erring on the side of releasing documents, public's right to know, that kind of thing. And we know that the family members very much do not want crime scene photos released. And I really hope they're not released.
I do too. The parents are saying, and this is so true, let our children have their dignity.
Right.
Because once you release those photos, that's all anybody's going to see. Not the beautiful smiling faces of all of these people in front of their house when they're there getting ready to go to a football game or whatnot.
Right.
Those are the images they deserve to have us remember.
Some of the parents don't want the toxicology reports released. And, you know, my position on that is it doesn't matter. There's nothing that can be written in that toxicology report that will justify anything.
Right.
So, but anyway.
And we already know they were pre-gaming. And if there was other things involved, so who cares?
Exactly.
Would that have changed anything?
Right.
No.
So there's a bunch of exhibits that were sealed, a bunch of guilty plea advisory forms, a bunch of documents, 43 yeah. documents. As this process goes along, because this is an ongoing process, the release of these documents. In fact, Kaylee's dad was not really happy with that process. He said they've just trickled out. He's like, let's just dump. Like, he wants to protect what he wants to protect. But one of his criticisms specifically was that he was finding out information at the same time the general public was. But anyway, so.
And they have a right to know.
Yeah, so exactly.
By that, I mean the parents have a right to know
right.
first.
And I do believe that the prosecutor was including them on, you know, in as much as the prosecutor could. But you can't taint the evidence. You can't taint the testimony. You do have to hold your cards close to the vest as a prosecutor.
If anything new comes up, any of these documents that come up warrant additional information that we all want to know, we will put a video on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook.
Thanks so much.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.